Hello, I'm Sam Fisher. This is number 0528, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of The Stuff File Program, number 0528. And coming up on this edition of The Stuff File Program, we remember host, actress, and comedian Suzanne Wong, who we recently just lost from cancer. We go back to 2009 and a conversation we had with her when we talked about how she got the role on NBC's Las Vegas.
It was just a co-starring role, five lines, one scene with Vanessa Marcel, who played my boss, Samantha. And I just did this one scene where I'm the spa manager of the Montecito Hotel that James Caan, you know, is the owner of. And I get confronted by my boss, played by Vanessa, that I have overcharged this woman for her bikini wax. And Polly says, "You see her before? She hairy like a man. I have to go all the way around corner clean basement. I lift up a sheet, look like a jungle."
Jeff Abraham, co-author of The Show Won't Go On, which shares stories of performers who died on stage. Apparently, there's no shortage of these.
The original title was The 99 Most Shocking, and the author thought there were too many stories, and he thought it was actually a little bit, pun intended, overkill. So we were able to whittle it down to the most thrilling, as we say in the subtitle, the most shocking, bizarre, and historic death.
Alex de Vrent is a bar owner in Belgium who has solved the problem of stolen beer mugs. Before they get a drink, customers have to give up a shoe, which is then raised to the roof.
We have a solution, but that's only for the big glass from 90 euro. There, most of the people get the shoe, and the shoe go in the basket. And when you finish with the beer, then you get your shoe back. That's a good solution because the people don't like it to go home with one shoe.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0528, was Sam Fisher, who is a sommelier at the Montreal eatery Restaurant Le Filet. And he's also a listener of the Stuff File program. You can find out where the restaurant is and all about it by going to their website, and you'll find the link for the website on our website page at thestufffile.com. All you have to do is go to the show number that you just heard Sam mention, which is 0528. Again, it all comes around full circle. Thank you very much, Sam, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Here's a story that started out innocently enough, but then took a bizarre turn. A road-tripping couple stopped in Grosse Tate, Louisiana, on September 18th to let their deaf puppy relieve himself. As they stretched their legs, they wandered over to the Tiger Truck Stop Petting Zoo and an enclosure that's home to Casper the Camel, and the man started throwing treats inside. But when their dog breached the fence to get the treats, the woman, ignoring no trespassing signs, followed. As she chased the dog, her husband shoved the camel and swatted him with his hat. That's when Casper lost his cool, settling his 600-pound camel booty right on top of the woman. So, you have the picture in your head, right? A large camel is sitting on top of a woman. So what do you think happened next? Any guess you have is probably wrong. According to what she told officers of the Iberville Parish Sheriff's Office, she did the only thing she could do. "I bit his balls to get him off of me."
Could you repeat that, sir?
Okay. "I bit his balls to get him off of me." Deputy Lewis Hamilton Jr. cited the couple for leash law violations and criminal trespassing, siding with Casper. The camel did nothing wrong, Hamilton stated. The camel has never been aggressive. A veterinarian treated the camel with antibiotics after the incident. You know what I find ironic about this story? September the 18th was a Wednesday.
Guess what day it is, huh? Anybody?
That's right, hump day. I'll bet Casper no longer cares about what day it is.
Hump day?
A Trumbull County, Ohio sheriff's deputy pulled over an Amish buggy early on the morning of September 15th after the officer noticed a few oddities about the vehicle. For one, there were two Amish men inside who were drinking, and on the buggy's roof rode a 12-pack of beer. And the old-fashioned conveyance sported an unlikely modern convenience, a stereo system with large speakers. As soon as the buggy came to a stop, the two men jumped out and escaped into heavy woods near the road. Meanwhile, the horse trailing the buggy took off. The officer was able to catch up with the horse and have the buggy towed. The driver was still at large. Said Chief Deputy Joe Dragovich, "The buggy is a vehicle. It's on the roadway, and the laws do apply. You're not allowed to drink and drive or operate a buggy." Okay, what I'd like to know is, what two drunken Amish men who have a stereo with large speakers on their buggy listens to? Please tell me it's hip-hop. Or better yet, Weird Al.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity.
And we have one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first segment here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Two football-crazed fans of Kansas City Chiefs QB Patrick Mahomes couldn't quite pull off a heist in Lawrence, Kansas on September 16th. Pulling up to a McDonald's, the two ran inside, grabbed a life-size cardboard cutout of Mahomes, and ran out, stuffing the promotional piece into their car. Lawrence police spokesman Patrick Compton said that as they received the call about the theft, they were working a car crash nearby in which one of the vehicles just happened to have a Mahomes cutout in the back seat. Officers questioned the suspects and ordered them to appear for alleged theft. Flat Pat was returned to the McDonald's. You know, these two knuckleheads should know better. You can't just manhandle a cutout of last year's NFL MVP like that. It's sacrilegious. There must be some kind of penalty for that.
Personal foul, roughing the passer, 15-yard penalty, automatic, first down.
Yeah, that seems about right. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? You know, another light has dimmed in Hollywood, and this is someone I personally knew. Actress, host, and brilliant stand-up Suzanne Wong has left us all too soon. She was only 56. Suzanne died of cancer. She was first diagnosed 13 years ago, was in remission a couple of times, most recently in 2016, diagnosed as cancer-free, but unfortunately, this year it came back. The last time she was on this program was back in 2016, as I mentioned, talking about her then-positive diagnosis and also a new movie that she was working on called A Weekend with the Family. You can hear that conversation on Stuff File program number 0345, but I thought the best way to honor the host of HGTV's House Hunters and one of the stars of NBC's series Las Vegas was to go back to one of our first conversations 10 years ago on my old live radio show in May of 2009. I had to do a lot of editing to bring this one to you because when talking to Suzanne, it was never a simple conversation. There would be laughing, we'd go off on tangents, we'd get silly, and she would ask me probably just as many questions as I would ask her. Remember, in addition to all the things she did, she was also a talk show host herself, so we'd often playfully wrestle control of the conversation from each other. Here now is just part of an early conversation from May 21st, 2009, with Suzanne Wong.
I come from an ethnic background. My family are from the West Indies. Mm-hmm. Your family from Korea.
Yes.
So isn't there a more of a discipline situation amongst Korean kids as well? Did you rebel against your parents?
Sure. I rebelled in my own way. I mean, I was pretty much an ideal kid, I would have to say. And by the way, I read that you, the people you admire most are your parents, and I would have to say the same thing about my parents, because I have those ideal parents that every day kissed me and hugged me and told me they loved me and made me laugh and told me that I was wonderful and that anything is possible for me in my life. And I guess most parents don't treat their kids that way. And so I feel incredibly blessed and fortunate to have those parents. Having said that, you know, in Korean culture, education is very, very, very important, and getting straight A's and succeeding and doing well. And that was very stressful, to be trying to get straight A's all the time, no matter what, and just must achieve and succeed. And so my big way of rebelling was I went to Yale, and then I got straight A's in high school, went to Yale, went to Brown, but dropped out of the Brown PhD program and only got a master's degree. Isn't that scandalous?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I should just be hanged.
So what were you taking? What was the direction you were going in when you were in university?
I got a BA in psychology at Yale. I showed up thinking that I would major in math because I was good at math, like a good Asian. But then as soon as I got to Yale, I looked through the Blue Book, which was the name of the course catalog, and as I was flipping through it, every single course in psychology seemed fascinating to me, and I circled every one of them and realized, ooh, it looks like I'm changing majors. Plus, even though Yale is a phenomenal place to study, as it turns out, I wasn't that impressed with the math classes that I took there, and all the psychology courses were fantastic. And I got a BA in psychology, and then at Brown I got a master's in cognitive psychology, which was my branch of specialization, which is the study of all cognitive processes like attention, vision, memory, language acquisition, things like that. And I had a blast studying psychology. In fact, you know how important those teachers are in junior high school and high school? At least for me, my high school psychology teacher, Mrs. Whitman, was kooky and offbeat and fascinating and funny, and had us do these experiential, interactive, experimental types of things in psychology class to sort of teach us what we were talking about in a form that we could actually tangibly experience, instead of just reading about it in textbooks. And I think that that had much to do with the fact that I was so fascinated by psychology by the time I got to college.
So let me speak on behalf of your parents. What happened?
You mean, why do I pretend for a living now?
Yes.
To make people laugh instead of being a psychology professor? Well, after I left Brown with my master's, which, by the way, they call a terminal master's. If you leave a PhD program and only get a master's degree, they call it a terminal master's, like you died somehow. Anyway, I moved to Boston and was working at a healthcare consulting firm, and ended up doing extra work on the show Spencer for Hire with Robert Urich, and completely changed career paths. And I would say by accident, but I no longer believe that there are any accidents or random coincidences or anything like that. So, and I think for the first, I don't know, couple of weeks, they were nervous, thinking, oh no, we're going to have to support her financially for the rest of her life. She wants to pretend for a living. But it quickly became clear that I think the first 20 auditions I went on in Boston, I booked 18 of them. And so I didn't have any sort of blockage or obstacles to thinking that I could do this for my life. And, you know, they're my biggest fans. They do the non-Korean thing. It's very non-Korean to brag about your children. That scene is very low class. They break that rule all the time. They're constantly proud of me and bragging about all of my accomplishments. So,
Plus, on some episodic television shows, you've actually played a doctor.
Many times.
Yes.
Like many doctors. So, you know, that part of them that secretly wishes that I were a doctor gets to live vicariously through those shows.
your parents could take steals from those shows and just put them up in the house.
That's right, and yet they'd rather have a still of me in a movie with Steve Martin and show that to people. So that's good news.
Okay, so when you first started doing the comedy, and one of the things for people, and I think the last time you were on the program, I actually mentioned this. I've actually made money on you in the past.
How have you done that?
Because when Las Vegas was still on NBC.
Yes, which, by the way, it's on TNT every day in reruns.
Excellent, excellent. I would tell people, I said, you know the lady who plays Polly on Las Vegas? That's the same person who hosts House Hunters. And they go, no.
And you
there's
say,
no
I'll
way.
$100.
Well, I don't go that high. Because that's a sucker's bet. I just, you know. But I've had a lot of dinners.
Well, you're not alone. I've gotten a lot of email from people saying, you have to settle a bet between me and my husband.
Mm-hmm.
I say it's the same person. He says there's no way in the world that that's the same person. So, yeah, I developed a stand-up comedy character named Sung Hee Park in acting class back in 2002. And Sung Hee Park is fresh off the boat from Korea in the traditional Korean dress, immigrant, doesn't speak English that well, has come to America to be a stand-up comedian and has no idea what she's doing and is nervous and shaking and could burst into tears if it doesn't go well, and then proceeds to tell the most horrific, offensive, vulgar, blue, racist jokes, but she has no idea what she's saying. And the whole point is that it's a satire on ignorance and racism and stereotypes in America, and she's just a fish out of water who is sweet and naive and innocent and trying to do well. And it's my send-up on how ridiculous all these words are and how ridiculous it is to try to pigeonhole people when you take one look at them. It's not that different from Archie Bunker's character on All in the Family, and it's a little Andy Kaufman as Latka in the show Taxi.
So, which is ironic, because you won the first Andy Kaufman Award.
I did. You're the best interviewer. By the way, what is it like to be on the air alone before you have a guest on? What is it like to talk and have nobody say anything back to you? Because I've never been in that position. Every time I've been on the radio, I'm either interviewing someone or being interviewed.
Well, it's just telling a story, like the openings of House Hunters.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's like telling a story.
Except, I don't know why, it just seems more like if I were doing stand-up comedy on stage and there was no audience. Because you know what it is? It's because you're funny. You're smart and you're funny, and there's nobody around that gets to react to you.
I alluded to Polly from the television series Las Vegas, and I've been on a few sets before, and I can't imagine how the cast and crew got through scenes with a straight face when you were on, because you were just hysterical, and I find it hard to believe that everything you said was on the printed page.
Oh, no. Much of what I said was not on the printed page, but the way that happened is that I got the audition, and I was printing out the script in my house for this role, and it was so much like my Sung Hee Park character that I had been doing as a stand-up comedian for years that I thought, oh, I feel sorry for anyone else who's coming to audition for this role because this is my role. And so I just showed up, and I knocked it out of the park because it was in my bone marrow. I had been working on this very character, and it's just so funny to me that it was a white guy in Hollywood who wrote that part for the show, and it was just spot on. So it was just a co-starring role, five lines, one scene with Vanessa Marcel, who played my boss, Samantha. And I just did this one scene where I'm the spa manager of the Montecito Hotel that James Caan, you know, is the owner of, and I get confronted by my boss, played by Vanessa, that I have overcharged this woman for her bikini wax. And Polly says, you see her before? She hairy like a man. I have to go all the way around corner, clean basement. I lift up a sheet, look like a jungle. And that was actually what was written on the page. And I thought, this is not possible that NBC wrote this and approved it. What's happening? And so I go and I do it, and it's Vanessa and I had spoken a little bit before we shot, and it, you know, everyone was loving it and laughing, and then Then we're done. And Vanessa says to the director, hey, Robbie, Suzanne's a stand-up comic. Why don't you give her a free take? And Robbie said, oh, okay. Go ahead, Suzanne. Ad lib, improvise, say whatever you want. Don't worry about the censors. And I thought, what's happening right now? This beautiful lead actress, you know, a lot of times when you're on a set, if there's an attractive female also on the set that's a regular on the show, she does not want to be kind to you or be generous, you know? And now she's giving me this great opportunity. So I went ballistic, and the crew guys were clamping their hands over their mouths and shaking and falling off their chairs because now I'm being treated like I'm Jim Carrey or Robin Williams or, you know, some crazy comedian. And it went so well when I did that, every time I came back on the show, somehow it was passed down to whoever was directing or producing that episode that when Suzanne is done with the words that NBC printed on the page, let her say whatever she wants. And it became a tradition, and it became so effective that every time I would watch a new episode that I was on of Las Vegas, I would get some popcorn and cross my fingers because some crazy thing that I ad-libbed would end up on the show. I mean, I think I can say this word on your show. I made a fisting reference.
Oh, man.
Just to make the crew guys laugh once, positive that that would never make it on the air, and the editor left it in.
Wow.
I mean, that just is, it really is beyond my comprehension, and I had such a great time working on that show, and I'm thrilled that they're showing reruns on TNT all the time, so there's still airplay, there's still an audience for it, and it just brings me so much bliss to work on something like that. And it's also because of Vanessa that it became a recurring role. Every time there'd be a new script written, Vanessa would go to the writers and say, yeah, here's where Polly can be in this scene, because she just wanted me back on the set.
Excellent.
And you're right. People had a really hard time keeping a straight face. Molly Sims, when we would do an over-the-shoulder of Molly looking at a close-up of me, Molly wouldn't even look at my face. She would look down. She couldn't even look at me because her whole body would start shaking.
That was a fun show.
So much fun, yes.
Yeah. And we mentioned the other show, House Hunters, which you can see all day, every day, several times a day. Here on HGTV in Canada, I don't know what it's like in the States, but in Canada, they play two back-to-back.
Mm-hmm. We do that in the States, too.
So we see it all the time. And to me, it's like a game show. It's like, I'm trying to figure out which one will they pick.
That's right. Is it one, two, or three? And it's weird that you would say that because I actually am going to be doing hosting on the Game Show Network. I've done some guest hosting on GSN Live.
Right.
And it's these interstitials during commercial breaks and in between game shows where they have live hosts come on and do take in callers and do miniature, you know, contests, and you can win things. And it's been so much fun. I'm thrilled about that. So it looks like it's turning into a regular gig for me, which will be so much fun. I don't know about you, but I grew up watching game shows. I grew up watching Pyramid and Password and Match Game and Family Feud.
Same here.
I was always obsessed with those shows. So I would love to host my own game show eventually, because think about it. Would you know many female hosts?
Betty White did a couple of few shows, but you're right.
But Meredith Vieira took over from Millionaire, and there was that woman on The Weakest Link, and that is it.
Absolutely.
The whole history of game shows, so I'm really looking forward to that.
One of the things, too, and I mentioned that earlier, the situation with Twitter, people talking about you and on HGTV, you know, you must know that there are people out there who imitate your cadence on that show.
I know. Not only that, but apparently I wiggle my shoulders back and forth when I speak, and there's a big thing about the Suzanne, the Wong wiggle. And, you know, I don't experience it when I'm doing it, and I don't even necessarily see what they're talking about, but people are adamant that I do that. And there's also, there used to be a big controversy about my bangs, because at one point I decided to try to grow my bangs out because I was bored. But when you grow your bangs out, there's a period during which it's sort of uncomfortable because they're not bangs, but they're not long enough. So, you know, it's just, like, not very flattering. And people used to send me emails saying, we hate you. You look terrible without bangs. You could show a movie on your forehead.
Oh, man.
I mean, really, the cruelty to go from loving me to hating me because of 2 inches of hair. I mean, that's pretty incredible. So, and I was determined to never have bangs again just to spite everyone, and then I realized that I agreed with them. They were right. I was really disgruntled by the fact that I agreed with them, so I will probably always have bangs from now on. I'll be happy to know.
That's part of a conversation from May 2009 with actress, host, and comic Suzanne Wong. She was such a delightful person to talk to, and for me, an even more delightful person to get to know. I was lucky enough to know her both on the mic and off air as well. Suzanne passed away September 17th after a 13-year battle with cancer. She will be missed. As I mentioned earlier, the last time she was on this show was Stuff File program number 0345, where she talked about her cancer remission. I urge you to go and listen to that conversation as well. I've put a link to it on this week's Stuff File program page. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of the show Won't Go On. Plus, we will meet a bar owner from Belgium who has a new and inventive way to stop people from stealing his expensive beer mugs. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news right here, right now on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. A woman bicycling topless down the center of U.S. Highway 98 on Okaloosa Island, Florida, turned out to be a shoplifting suspect fleeing the scene of a crime. At about 7 p.m., a worker at Surfside Outfitters reported a woman having left the store without paying for a pair of flip-flops and something else she'd shoved into a bag. And by the way, full disclosure, there are few sounds in life that I find more annoying than the sound of flip-flops on pavement or flooring. It's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. Anyway, not long after, reports of a bare-chested bicyclist began to stream in. Deputies apparently did not find it difficult to locate the suspect, but rounding her up proved more of a challenge. When a deputy pulled alongside and told her to stop, the woman replied, "Make me." The woman's arrest report stated that the deputy commanded the woman to pull to the side of the road and stop. The woman refused several times, and finally, the deputy got ahead of her and stopped the woman as she tried to pedal past. Officers found the items reported stolen, including a $25 T-shirt. The woman, a Baton Rouge resident, who the arrest report noted had worked as a bartender and in marketing, was charged with retail theft and resisting arrest without violence. Okay, here's the part of the crime that I don't understand. How does a woman get arrested for topless cycling after she has shoplifted a T-shirt? Shouldn't one crime literally cover up the other one? Yeah. And according to Taylor Parker, who was taking a shower in his house, it basically felt like an earthquake. The whole house was shaking for a good 20, 25 seconds. He got out of the shower and ran outside in a towel. He went on to say, "All I see is a big bulldozer tearing up my yard and went through the house. He got in front of the bulldozer and pulled out the driver. When Spring Hill, Tennessee police arrived and questioned the driver denied being on drugs, but claimed there was a mound of dirt and it was his job to relocate it. Police took a blood sample. "We want to make sure we cross our T's and dot our I's before we assess the charges," said Lieutenant Justin Whitwell. The driver was not immediately taken to jail. I think the cops are burying the lead here, because if he was not on drugs when he decided to drive a bulldozer into someone's house, is that perfectly okay and legal? I don't know. Anyway, and finally in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a British man was put in a very awkward situation when he was accused of stealing items from a shop and putting them into his pants. Steve Whitehurst was shopping at a store in Stoke-on-Trent, England, when a manager asked about his bulge. Whitehurst claims he told her it was his penis. "Eventually, I dropped my trousers in front of everyone and just stood there in my boxer shorts and said, 'See, I've got nothing to hide.' Reportedly, she kept pestering him, and he finally went to another room and showed the security guard that he wasn't stealing anything and that the bulge was all natural. The store claims that nobody told him he had to show his penis, but that he just did it himself." Well, you know, some people believe in the old adage that, if you got it, flaunt it. I, however, suggest that he wear less form-fitting clothing. But I'm guessing that this news story is making him much more popular in the neighborhood. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? There is an old saying that says, the show must go on. But what if someone actually dies during the show? That's the topic of a new book called The Show Won't Go On. It's co-written by Jeff Abraham, and he joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Jeff.
How are you? Always good to chat with you, Peter.
Good to have you on the program. Now, you have co-written this book, so tell us a little bit about the co-writer and also how you two came together to write this book in the first place.
I had known the wonderful Bert Kearns, my co-author, for about 20 years. I was a publicist for a book he did about tabloid journalism called Tabloid Baby. And then he's also an investigative journalist and a filmmaker, and we've worked together over the last 20 years on various projects. I had come up with the project, with this book idea, a little over 15 years ago. I went to see an Elvis tribute show, and part of the show was a gentleman named Al DeVorin, who most people will know from this phrase: "Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building. Thank you and good night." And I saw the show on a Saturday. He died the next morning at 9:30. And it really, put a little shock into me. And I thought about an idea of a book about people who died going to a show, coming home from a show, dying on stage. And I came up with this title. And that's all I came up with. And then Bert and I were chatting one day, and he goes, "Let's just do this." So for the last 3 years, Bert and I have been collaborating on this book, and this is the book you now have in your hand.
Now, I know two of the stories that are in the book from before knowing about your book. I knew about Dick Shawn, and I knew about the guest on the Dick Cavett Show. But are there, and we'll get to those in a moment, but are there a lot of cases of this?
Most definitely. Otherwise, I would have written a pamphlet and not a book. In fact, the original title was The 99 Most Shocking, and the author thought there were too many stories, and he thought it was actually a little bit, pun intended, overkill. So we were able to wheedle it down to the most, thrilling, as we say in the subtitle, the most shocking, bizarre, and historic deaths. That's the thing about the book. Like I said, the original intention was people who died before show, after, but we came across so many people who literally died on stage, it it really was enough to fill a book, and if not, a sequel.
Now, even though you're writing this book with your co-author, when you first started, did you think there were this many of them?
No, like I said, no, I really didn't. I mean, I knew more than the two you had mentioned. I knew about Albert Brooks' father, and I knew that Carl Wallenda died in mid-performance, and I knew some stuntmen, and then we had some criteria to narrow it down, but no, I was quite shocked by the number of performers that we found going back, and I got to tell you, in the last year alone, close to over a dozen performers have died on stage, you know, six in the last few weeks. It's amazing. I mean, the people who are dying to get into our books is escalates all the time.
Wow. Okay, so three of them. I mentioned two. You mentioned one. Let's delve a little bit into some of those.
You got it.
The Dick Cavett guest. I've heard this story told several times by Dick Cavett, but share the story about the guest who literally died on his set.
Well, I'm glad you didn't say you've seen that show, because many people do claim they've seen that episode. In fact, Mr. Cavett, who we interviewed for the book, says about 20 people a year come up to him and said, "The look on your face." And we were very fortunate. A very dear friend of mine, who I believe was on your show, named Robert Bader, who works for Dick Cavett, gave us access to that episode. We were among the first people to ever watch that episode. You can literally count on one hand the number of people who have seen it before. So he had a gentleman on his show named J.I. Rodale, who was a longevity/health expert. How's that for a person who's going to die on television? And he was talking, did his segment, moved over one chair, and the next guest was the newspaper columnist Pete Hamill. And while Pete was into his interview a few minutes, you heard a snoring sound, which always made the rumor. We came across, the rumor has happened that Dick Cavett said, "Am I boring you?" Because it sounded like he was snoring, but it was actually the sound of, you know, the death rattle, you know, the sound of someone's last breath. And then they realized there was something terribly wrong, and Dick Cavett was just about to say, "Is there a doctor in the house?" which is a great cliche, but realized it would get a laugh. And he literally stopped himself and said, Is there a doctor? I think there's something wrong." And then the tape continues to roll, and we actually see, you know, the scuttlebutt of people trying to help this man, but unfortunately he had died.
Wow. Now, a more famous one, and I say more famous because people knew him, was Dick Shawn. He died on stage as well.
Yeah, you know, we all know Dick Shawn from Mad World and the producers. He was a brilliant avant-garde stand-up performer who had been traveling the country to critical acclaim with a show called The World's Second Greatest Entertainer. Now he was ready to do a variation on that. So he was down at the University of San Diego. And, you know, when the show would open, he would be lying on the stage under a pile of newspapers and literally pop up. So there was a lot of unpredictableness in the show. So at one point in the show, he says, "Imagine an atomic blast has gone off, and everyone in the world is gone except for the people in this theater, and I am your leader, and I want you to follow me." And almost on cue, he literally fell to the floor and had a heart attack. And his son, who was the stage manager, was watching, goes, "You know, I don't think he falls on the..." He didn't think. He goes, "I know my dad doesn't take a fall at that point in the show. I don't think there's anything, I don't think there's something right going on." And they checked, and he had a heart attack.
Wow. And one that you mentioned, which I wasn't necessarily familiar with, and that was Albert Brooks' father.
Yeah, Albert Brooks' real name was Albert Einstein. His brother was Bob Einstein, better known as Super Dave. And their father was a comedian named Harry Einstein, who worked with a Greek dialect called a character named Park Your Carcass in radio with Eddie Cantor. In his later years, he was not in good health, but the last year before his life, he was starting to bounce back a little bit and was a favorite at a lot of Friars functions. So there was a Lucy Desi testimonial dinner, and Harry was asked to be on it. And to use an old show business cliche, that night he killed. And the audio is available. I believe you can find it on our website, theshowwon'tgoon.com. And he is brilliant. And he sits, after his performance, he sits down, and Art Linkletter, who was the MC, says, "I just don't understand why this man does not work more often." And almost on cue, his head fell into the lap of Milton Berle, who was next to him on the dais, and he died on a heart attack.
Wow.
And Albert Brooks says, "Is that not the most poetic way to go out? He didn't die on the way to the show. He didn't die in mid-performance. He literally died at the end of the performance, got his last laugh, and died."
Now, these are the kind of stories I enjoy. These are the kind of stories I love. And I'm sure your book is going to be a great success. But when you were first pitching the book, did people come to you? Or when you were writing the book, if you're telling people, "This is what I'm working on," did anybody say to you, "Well, gee, that's a morbid topic"?
Yeah, we heard morbid. I think one literary agent said it best. He said, "This is the worst mystery novel I've ever read. People die in the first page of every chapter." I will tell you honestly, in the beginning, I was, the book was going to be much more comprehensive, and I was very bored by reading an early draft, because you read it and the person goes, "And he had a heart attack, and he had a heart attack, and he had a heart attack." So we wanted to then find people whose stories were so engaging that you really were taken by their journey to their last performance. That was one factor. Also, because of the book, we have people who were, there was murderers and suicides and magicians who were, shot while doing the buried bullet catch. A magician who was buried alive. So there were variations on it. So it was not the same theme. So that, and then I've always said, what's the button? Is there something at the end that makes this stand out? And like the woman who dies while playing "There's No Business Like Show Business," or the woman who dies while singing "Talk About Me While I'm Gone," or the actor who dies in a play called "Anatomy of a Murder." A number of ironic things that appeared made the chapters very intriguing. And the other thing that was more important than anything was not to be snarky. Even though the book has the word death in the title, it's really a celebration of these performers, their lives. And many of them are not well known, but to pay tribute to these performers.
The book is called "The Show Won't Go On," and you mentioned already the website, theshowwon'tgoon.com. Jeff, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Jeff Abraham, co-author of "The Show Won't Go On." You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0528, and you'll find links to Jeff's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. The best thing since sliced bread. No loafing here.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet a Belgian bar owner with a unique way to prevent theft. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. An Austrian couple expecting a dress in the mail opened a large package that arrived at their home and instead found nearly 25,000 ecstasy pills. Upper Austria police said a 58-year-old woman in Linz bought a dress online from a Netherlands retailer and opened the package she thought had contained the garment. The box turned out to contain thousands of what she initially thought were decorative stones, but her 59-year-old husband soon suspected to be drugs. The couple returned the package to the post office, and police determined the box's contents were 24,800 ecstasy tablets, with an estimated street value of nearly $550,000. Okay, if I had received the package, I wouldn't have just waltzed it back to the post office. I would have called the cops right away. I mean, too much can go horribly wrong when you're carrying drugs in public, and you know you're carrying drugs in public. Also, I'm just trying to imagine the other side of this scenario. Somewhere out there could be a drug dealer who just received a dress. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? This is another situation where I was looking for news items for the Stuff File program, and when I found this story, I had to dig a little deeper and find someone to talk to about it. There is a problem in the bars and pubs in Belgium. People keep stealing their decorative beer mugs and steins. One bar has come up with an idea on how to combat that. Before you get your beer, you have to hand over your shoes, and your shoes go in a basket that is raised to the roof. It's unique, but it's effective. On the line with us right now is bar owner Alex De Vrent to tell us about it. He is in Ghent, Belgium. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
First of all,
it's a pleasure.
I'm sure a lot of people don't understand the complexity of the problems. We should mention the fact that your very decorative beer steins and mugs, they are expensive. Tell us about the steins, first of all, the beer mugs.
The beer mug, we are a pub with 500 different beers. And of course, it's always a problem. Some people, much of tourists, they have a very nice pleasure with the souvenir of the pub. You want to pick the glasses, of course.
How much does each beer mug or stein cost? What's it worth?
Well, it's different. It's much different. Of course, we have one special one. It's 90 euros. It's a very big glass from 1.2 liters. It's the beer of the house, but special tradition, of course. And double glasses, you can buy the other glasses with us for 2.5 to 5 euro, I think.
Okay.
That's almost the most glasses.
But again, a beer mug that costs 90 euros, it's obviously something of great value. If people are stealing it, I can see why it would become a problem. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you're not the only bar that has to deal with this situation. It's a situation that's happening all across your country. You just came up with a unique way to combat that. How did you come up with the idea of taking customers' shoes?
Well, the problem of the cost, of course, is in all the bars where you have much of tourists, you have that problem, of course. You have one pub in Bruges, they are working with chips on the glasses. But we do that you're going in a marketplace. You go out and then you go to some scanners, and when you have a glass, then it's beep, beep, beep. Of course, when you're sitting outside, the problem is the same. Thus, we have a solution, but that's only for the big glass from 90 euro. There, most of the people give the shoe, and the shoe go in the basket. And when you finish it, the beer, then you get your shoe back. That's a good solution because the people don't like it to go home with one shoe. Eh?
So you only take one shoe and put it in the basket. They get to keep one on, so to speak?
Yes, there's one shoe for the basket and one shoe you keep in you. We take only one shoe from the people who want to drink that beer. Well, I said it's only for the beer from the house, the Max. It's a very special glass. I cannot tell you at the radio, not the photo or so. But it's a beautiful glass. It's very expensive. It's a special make it for us. And it's always in the production, of course, that makes the price so high. Mm-hmm. And when you can sell the glass, of course, it's no problem. You want to buy a glass, you can do that for 90 euro. But of course, we don't want to take the glass outside, of course. But sometimes in the year, two or three times, we have sometimes at the end of the evening, we have one shoe in a basket and we have no people in the bar. And we know it's one. Disappeared, of course.
Mm. Before you started doing this, how much money would you lose in a month or even in a year from people stealing the glasses?
Oh, that's a very, very difficult question, right? Because we know the stock of the glasses in the bar. Every week we check the stock and we put it on. Of course, it's not the only reason to take the glasses, also broken and so. There's of course, the deficit for us is not so big because much of breweries give the when you normal working, you get also much glasses for free from the breweries. For us, it's not so big. It's of course a special glass for us, but we make special for us. Of course, that's a cost for us. Of course, but I think the money we lose is not so much. I think maybe a few. 100 euro every month, why not more, I think.
But it does add up. So since you started this situation by putting a shoe in a basket, you've also gained, I mean, I'm calling you right now, so you've also gained a little bit of notoriety for doing this. What kind of reaction have you received from, first of all, your clients, and also from people like me in the media, both local and abroad?
But for the people in the bar, it's very easy. You must know now with much of social media and so Instagram, Facebook, and etc. It's of course in very good publicity, and much people come just to the pub for drinking a beer in the glass, while you must give your shoe. This is now is it more an attraction for the pub than of course. Staying at the depot, the shoe is deposited for the glass, but it's also now it's an attraction for the pub. There's much people. I have also another business in the city here, and sometimes we have people who are in that place, and they ask just where I can bring the beer, why I must give my shoe. You understand? This? Now it's an attraction. When you visit Ghent, I say always you must see the Lamb Huts. And you must drink a beer to eat. Well, that's the reason why you must come to Ghent.
Well, again, let me, in the few moments we have left, I know you've got a website, and I'm going to put the link of your website up onto our website so people can go there. But for those who are listening right now, tell us the name of your pub and exactly where it's located and what makes it unique besides the fact that you take people's shoes. Tell us a little bit about your bar.
Well, first of all, my name is De Le Griet. It's a Flemish name, of course. We are in Ghent. It's one of the most beautiful cities of Belgium, I think. More beautiful than some other more touristic places in Belgium. And what is special for us pub is, of course, is first of all, is the big assortment from beers. Because we have 500 different Belgian beers, the bar. We have almost all the Heusen we find in Belgium. You can taste it in our pub. And now we have a beautiful assortment from every kind of taste of beer. It's in the market on Belgium, but especially Belgian beers. And of course, the attraction, the big glass where you have your shoe. It's always an attraction. It's a beautiful moment for companies when you're on holiday and you want something special.
Alex, it's a unique idea you've got, and it seems to work well. Not only does it make sure that you keep your glasses in the bar, but it also brings some attention to the bar. So kudos on both marks. Thank you very much, Alex, for being on the program with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Alex DeVrent, bar owner in Ghent, Belgium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0528, and you can find the link to Alex's website, which gives you all the information you need should you want to visit his bar in Belgium. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
North Carolina police have apparently arrested a man for beating them in a donut-eating contest. The Elizabeth City man celebrated out-eating the police officers, only to find out that he couldn't outrun them. 24-year-old Bradley Herbert Hardison was arrested one day after he won the adult division of a donut-eating contest at the Elizabeth City Police Department's National Night Out Against Crime. Hardison downed 8 donuts in 2 minutes, beating a group that included local police officers and firefighters. The Camden County Sheriff's Office had been looking for Hardison in connection with 2 break-ins, but Sheriff Tony Perry admitted that nothing was taken during these break-ins. Hardison was charged with felony larceny and breaking and entering. And by the way, beating cops in a donut contest is not a crime. But why, oh why, would you show up at a police donut-eating contest the day after committing alleged crimes in the very same neighborhood? One reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0528. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0528. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder: who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?